This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hurricane Beryl was the first Atlantic Cat 4 storm ever seen in June. That is scary. It became the earliest Cat 5 as well. Will climate change foster superstorms bigger than anything before? Dr. James Hansen warns yes, and meteorologist Jeff Masters explains. But first, we revisit a fundamental interview with MIT's Dr. Carrie Emanuel, surely one of the world's top hurricane experts. Get informed and get ready. These are Best of Radio EcoShock replays, what you need to know about hurricanes in a new climate age. Our guest is a world expert in extreme storms. Dr. Carrie Emanuel is professor of atmospheric science at MIT and co-director of the Lorenz Center. Since his first paper in 1977, and well over 100 research papers later, Carrie's passion and research led to his 2005 book, Divine Wind, The History and Science of Hurricanes. Dr. Emanuel just co-authored two key papers warning about cyclones in a warming world. From New England, Carrie Emanuel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Good to be with you.
Considering we have at least a century of records about tropical cyclones, why do we still see very different projections of what could happen to big storms during climate change?
So part of the problem is a technical problem, is that we, you know, the climate is a very complex system. And because of that, we rely on rather sophisticated computer models to make detailed forward projections. And there are many different models around the world. That's deliberate because different people have to make different approximations, and we get some idea of the uncertainty that way. But the problem with all of these models is that they're not yet fine enough in resolution to really capture hurricanes. And so we have to make deductions that are a bit indirect. And so there are nevertheless some things that emerge fairly robustly from these studies, one of which is that, and basic theory, by the way, not just models, is that hurricanes ought to become more intense as we warm the climate. Not necessarily more frequent, but more intense. And we're beginning to see that happen. Another fairly robust finding is that as we warm the climate, the latitudes at which these storms tend to reach their peaks should increase in both hemispheres. They should be moving closer to the pole. And finally, and probably most importantly, a given storm is likely to rain a lot more in a warmer climate.
But frequency matters. In the Caribbean and North America, there were years when several large hurricanes, one after the other, slammed ashore before anyone could recover or rebuild. Another one wreaked more damage. Carrie, could predicting frequency be as important as knowing storm intensity?
Absolutely. And the fact that we aren't confident about that is just an honest statement of where the science is. It's not a statement that we don't think it's important. It's just a much tougher problem. And the Atlantic, by the way, is kind of a special place. We know it behaves a bit differently from the other oceans that have tropical cyclones. And there have been all kinds of things that have influenced the hurricane climate of the Atlantic, of which global warming is just one.
The strongest storm on record did happen in the Pacific in both size and wind speeds. It was Typhoon Tip in October 1979. Given what is known about the physics of tropical cyclones, is there a natural upward limit to how strong these storms could become?
There is an upward limit. In fact, I was the one who discovered it theoretically more than 30 years ago and published it in Nature magazine. But that upper limit is a function of the climate state. As you warm the atmosphere, or cool the very high atmosphere, if you warm the ocean and cool the high atmosphere, storms should become more intense. And we made projections back then that global warming would lead to a perceptible increase in the intensity of these storms.
The paper, Poleward Expansion of Tropical Cyclone Latitudes in Warming Climates, was published in Nature Geoscience December 29, 2021. Your team explains a key concept. About 30% of tropical cyclones are driven by factors heavily influenced by climate change. Can you explain that for the educated non-specialist?
Sure. There are all kinds of factors that influence hurricanes as they affect us. We have talked about intensity and frequency are two important factors that are controlled by the environment. But there are other factors. For example, where do these storms form? And once formed, where do they move? The tracks of the storms. Shifts in the tracks of the storms, which might accompany climate change, are terribly important because storms could move toward coastlines or away from coastlines, and even if their frequency is changing, that could be offset locally by the changes in the tracks. So at the end of the day, I like to say all climate change is local. That is, we can make sweeping statements about what happens to hurricanes around the world. Their frequency will do this, their intensity will do that. But what really matters to most people and what we're very concerned about is how does it change where you live or someplace you're concerned about? And you can have situations, and in fact, the model will show this, that global warming will actually decrease the intensity and or frequency of hurricanes in certain places, like Fiji in the South Pacific. So you have to be very careful to recognize that it's a complex problem, and yeah, the changes that we're worried about are local changes.
You and your colleagues examined cyclone conditions going back many millions of years. So what did you find?
So in that case, we looked at models of the past climates, including climates of the ice ages, and although I think more work needs to be done on that, we found that during very cold times, hurricanes, as theoretically expected, are not as intense, but they're actually more frequent in certain places. So, again, we have to be very careful about which of those results are really robust, but it's fascinating to look at the various factors that control hurricane activity.
And there were periods a few million years ago when Earth had more carbon in the atmosphere than today and was very hot. Did they have great storms then?
Well, you know, we'd like to know. And obviously one way of estimating that is to run computer models of the past. But I think most of us would feel more confident if we had direct evidence. Now, there is this budding field called paleotempestology, which does look for geological evidence of past storms. And so far, we've been able to look back only about 6,000 years. It's really tough to look back millions of years, but not out of the question. And so, yes, you ask an excellent question, and there are some indications that the storms millions of years ago when the climate was very warm were, in fact, more intense, but might have been less frequent.
Yeah, I recall in a 2016 paper, James Hansen and 18 co-authors shone a spotlight on storms in past ages stronger than anything seen today. They said some moved giant rocks inland on the Caribbean islands. Kerry Emanuel, what do you make of this theory, and does it point toward superstorms to come as we heat the planet?
Well, I think that the most robust result we have so far is this increase in the speed limit, if you will, of hurricane winds as you warm the climate or decrease as you cool it. And we're relatively confident about that, and we're very confident about the fact that warming air means more rain from a given storm. And of course, we'd like to know about the past, and that would certainly lend confidence in what we expect theoretically or make us go back to the drawing board. The water thing, I can't emphasize how important water is. It kills a lot more people than wind in hurricanes, both the freshwater flooding from torrential rains and the surge of salt water that's pushed forward by the storm. It's essentially the same thing as a tsunami, but forced by wind rather than shaking seafloor. Those are the devastating aspects of tropical cyclones worldwide and have killed far more people than wind. But it gets a lot less attention. And we're very worried about the fact that rising sea level and heavier rains are going to exacerbate flooding from hurricanes.
And you've got a new paper on that, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But looking at this December paper, you talk about poleward expansion. So bringing this down to Earth, what does your team's new analysis suggest for cities in the American Northeast, for example? Could New York become known as a storm city like New Orleans is?
Well, I hope not. And again, it tends to be a local thing. New York, because it's sort of set inland a little bit compared to, say, Cape Hatteras or Cape Cod, dodges most of the hurricanes that travel up that way. But we do show in the paper that, at least according to the analyses we did, in general, the Northeast should experience more storms as the climate warms. But there are maybe regions deep within the Caribbean, on the other hand, that experience a decrease in the number of storms. So the poleward expansion is not bad news for everyone. I wouldn't go so far as to say the storms in New York City will be as devastating as the ones in New Orleans. But, you know, if you look at it, all cultures, all cities, towns, habitations are really pretty well acclimated to the climate we've experienced in the last few hundred years. People build up an experience base. They know what to build for. Problems happen when things go outside the bounds of history. Then your structures, your highways, your subways weren't built for. And that's when the trouble really happens.
Does your work apply to so-called bomb cyclones like the damaging winter storm that recently struck New England?
You know, not directly. Our work doesn't directly apply to storms like that. As a matter of fact, you ask an excellent question, because these bomb cyclones, sometimes around here called nor'easters, do a lot of damage and are very costly. But the jury is out still on how climate change might affect storms like that. Theoretically, it's a very interesting problem. There are factors that would tend toward having more intense storms and other factors that would tend in the opposite direction. So we're still working on that. There's an awful lot to do in climate science still.
The December study in Nature looks at poleward shifts. Does it apply equally to expansion in the southern hemisphere, like the tropical cyclone Batsirai that just wiped out villages in Madagascar?
Yes, it should apply broadly in the southern hemisphere as well. And that cyclone that just hit Madagascar was devastating, but it wasn't unusual in the latitude it occurred at. Madagascar has suffered devastating cyclones in the past.
Well, staying in the south for a minute, tropical cyclones generally hit northern Australia and Queensland. Other than a deadly freak tropical cyclone in 1954, big cities like Sydney do not get cyclones. Could that change as the planet warms?
You know, that's a good question. I think we're in a position to at least take a shot at the answer to it. I don't think anyone has looked in great detail about how the poleward expansion might affect storms specifically in Australia, but it's a good question.
As you say, the conclusions of this December paper, it's a bit mixed. It seems there are different changes at work in different oceans. Storms in the Atlantic may be more influenced by changes in polar ice, while in the Pacific, ocean warming may draw big storms away from land and into the open ocean, a different storm track. Is that correct?
Yeah, all climate change is local. Whether those specific changes that are coming from our analyses and models are correct, we'll have to wait and see, but it's our best shot at it so far.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Carrie Emanuel from MIT. We're talking about dangerous changes in the most powerful storms as we overheat the world's climate. Let's move to your latest paper. With Avantika Gori and others, you co-author Tropical Cyclone Climatology Change Greatly Exacerbates U.S. Extreme Rainfall Surge Hazard. That's just out in Nature Climate Change, February 3rd. What is the connection between extreme rains and storm surges?
Well, they both cause flooding, but it's more interesting than that. What we're really worried about in this paper and in other papers is something called compound flooding, where you have both a surge of water trying to get to the sea from inland, resulting from torrential rains, and a temporary but large elevation of sea level because of the storm surge. The collision of those two can be somewhat worse than if they occurred separately, just adding their effects. We call that the compound hazard. We're very worried about that. And let me just explain again that water is much more of a threat than wind in most hurricanes. At least they've certainly killed a lot more people and done more damage historically. Not in all storms, but on average. The problem really is when you look at any risk of natural hazard, you see, of course, that the most devastating events are very rare. And it goes along with that, that if you shift the climate a bit, the biggest fractional changes in the incidence occur in the tails of the distributions. That's where you get the really large increases. And so when you try to convert a weather hazard like a hurricane into an actual risk, it's almost always dominated by the rarest, strongest events. So if you know, over a long period of time, it's those events which will cause the most damage. The problem is that, of course, we don't have very good historical records of very rare events, and they're harder to model. But generally speaking, where we are able to model them, as in this paper, you see the biggest changes in the tails of the distributions, and we certainly see that in the case of coastal flooding from hurricanes.
For years, from both scientists and environmentalists, we've seen maps of sea level rise and Miami goes under eventually and things like that. But you seem to explain that tropical cyclones are a threat to the U.S. coastal cities and the countryside, greater than rising sea levels. Could you explain that, please?
Yeah. So the rising sea level is a factor in the increased flood risk. So most of the floods that occur today don't occur under normal weather conditions, but occur when you have a storm that locally raises the elevation of the water, the so-called storm surge. So if you have sea level rise and you have a storm surge, and especially if it happens to be high tide when the storm happens, you sum all those three, you're much more likely to get flooding. And if the storm surge is having to fight against fresh water trying to escape to the sea from inland, it makes matters worse. So all of these things are compounding. And let me just say that in addition to that, we have a demographic problem that's been documented for some time all over the world, which is that people are moving into hurricane-prone regions. In fact, the number of people living in regions susceptible to hurricanes has tripled since 1970. And so even if the climatology of these storms didn't change, we would have a lot more damage from these storms, and we certainly see a lot more damage. But on top of that, you have this collision of possibly stronger hurricanes, certainly rainier hurricanes, and in certain places, perhaps more hurricanes as well, and the increase in sea level. So all these factors are on a collision course, and it doesn't paint a very optimistic picture.
That's amazing. Millions of people are moving closer into the danger zone. Look, in 2018, I interviewed Dr. Jim Cawson of NOAA. He warned tropical cyclones or hurricanes are slowing down to leave a greater trail of destruction. It's sort of strange for the average listener because we hear that a hurricane may have winds of 150 miles an hour or greater, and yet it's slowly moving along at several miles an hour. What is translation speed in storms, and why does it matter so much?
Well, the translation speed is the rate at which the center of the storm moves across the sea or the land. So, you know, the typical storm in the North Atlantic may form, and the tropical Atlantic generally moves east or east-northeast and may recurve up to the north and west. But the speed at which it travels along that path is what we call the translation speed. Why it matters is all kinds of ways. Obviously, a fast-moving storm, you're not going to have as much time to evacuate people as if you have a slow-moving storm, assuming they both have fairly good track forecasts. A concern, though, is if you have a storm that stalls near the coastline, as did Hurricane Harvey back in 2017, then the rain can last a lot longer, and you can get much more rain at a point than you would if the storm is moving fast. But there are other considerations as well. If the storm is moving slowly inland, it's not going to get very far before it dies. So if you're a city that's 100 miles inland from the coast, you might be better off with a slowly translating storm than one that's moving quickly. So there are all these factors. And at the end of the day, each storm is an individual storm and has to be treated for the particular hazards that it poses. And we're constantly getting better, fortunately, at forecasting these kinds of storms.
Something caught my eye in your paper in Nature Geoscience. Your team writes, quote, atmospheric aerosols provide an additional control over tropical cyclone occurrence on shorter timescales. Kerry, does that imply that our smog may have muted the appearance of tropical cyclones? And if we clean air pollution up, we may get more of these giant storms.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence for that. Here's what's going on. When you put aerosols in the atmosphere, unless they're very dark aerosols like carbon black, if you put, for example, sulfate aerosols, the main effect is to reflect sunlight back to space. And that cools the ocean regionally where the aerosols have strong concentrations. I have to emphasize that aerosols are almost always regional. They're not global. They're not at all homogeneously distributed around the world because they don't stay in the atmosphere all that long, on average about 2 weeks. And so they don't get very far from, well, they get some distance from the source, but they don't last long enough to become uniform around the world. And that regional cooling can have profound effects on hurricanes. And we believe that the hurricane drought in the Atlantic in the 1970s and 1980s was an indirect effect of aerosols from fossil fuel combustion, mostly in northern Europe. Those aerosols get swept down over the Mediterranean and Africa in the summertime by the airflow at that time of year. They demonstrably caused a drought in the sub-Saharan region back in the 70s and 80s. And when you have a drought, a lot more dust from the desert gets lofted in the easterly winds and brought out over the Atlantic, and it's mostly that Saharan mineral dust that we think cooled the Atlantic in that period and led to a fairly dramatic reduction in both hurricane frequency and intensity. So, yeah, the Clean Air Act had, you might call it the black lining on the silver cloud of cleaning up the atmosphere, was it brought back the hurricanes.
Emissions are still going up, and in sort of a desperation, we hear more voices from good scientists talking about injecting stratospheric aerosols to cool the planet down could be needed in the future. What do we know about the impacts of doing that to storm intensity or frequency?
Well, fortunately, they'd be very small, and the reason is kind of simple. The amount of aerosol you'd have to put into the stratosphere to cool things down, and you would try to do that in a sort of globally uniform way, is pretty tiny compared to the amount of aerosol that we're accidentally already dumping into the lower part of the atmosphere we call the troposphere. So while there are many, you know, potential risks of doing this so-called solar radiation management, I don't think it's going to have that much effect regionally on hurricanes. But anytime you cool the whole climate down, as that's going to do, we would expect to ramp back down on the intensity of hurricanes. And in fact, I have a paper out with another group of authors that suggests that even if you only went halfway back to, say, the temperature of the pre-industrial era, you would probably go all the way back in terms of hurricane intensity. So, yeah, it does make a difference.
Is that paper already published?
Yes, it is. And the lead author, well, one of the authors is David Keith.
Ah, yes. We've interviewed David Keith and talked about him quite a bit. Now, you find the warming atmosphere could increase the polar shift, but may also decrease the chances tropical cyclones could happen. So it's a mixed bag in your December 2021 meta-analysis. That leads me to ask, is scientific knowledge about tropical cyclones solid enough now that we could warn people and governments what to prepare for, say, in 2030 or 2050?
Well, you know, it's an excellent question, and it's the most important question you can ask. Certainly, we don't know everything that we ought to know about these storms. And the projections are accompanied, and especially regionally, with a great deal of uncertainty. But I do think there, if you look at the robust parts of these results, I think they are sufficient to begin to take action. So, for example, just sea level rise, it's very clear that that's happening and will continue to happen. We need to already begin, we need to change our infrastructure to cope with sea level rise. And even if the hurricane climatology were not to change, you have a problem with higher storm surges just because they're riding on You know, there's simple things like that, very robust conclusions you can begin to design for. The wind problem or the frequency problem is not entirely solved, and yet, if you really stop and think about it, many of the decisions we make in the real world every day, and many of the decisions government have to make, are made in environments of uncertainty. We're never completely certain about the future. We have to think probabilistically about these things and weigh the probabilities that there will be serious risks to deal with against the losses that may come from spending money, from spending to mitigate those risks now. So those are the tough decisions that we have to contemplate.
Well, as you point out in your book, Divine Winds, these big storms can change history. I wonder, can you picture a sci-fi future where humans would be able to either divert the storm from its track and save a city or decrease its violence?
I can imagine things. I mean, there is, for example, an idea that's probably 10 or 15 years old, which is, I like to think of it as harnessing the butterfly. And what I'm alluding to there is the so-called, the well-known butterfly effect, which is a cornerstone of chaos theory developed by Ed Lorenz in the 1960s. Which says that the atmosphere can be very, very sensitive to very tiny perturbations. You know, you have a butterfly, at least proverbially, a butterfly flapping its wings in South America, leading a few weeks later to a tornado in Texas. Harnessing the butterfly is not pure science fiction. If you can introduce perturbations of the right shape in the atmosphere at a particular place and time, that will grow rapidly in amplitude as they move along the atmospheric currents. You can basically design such perturbations to achieve some desired effect. For example, a hurricane barreling toward the east coast of the U.S., if you tickle the atmosphere over the Pacific just the right way a few days earlier, you just change the natural progression of weather in such a way as the storm is turned harmlessly out to sea. That's not complete fantasy at all. There's a question of can we robustly design those perturbations, be relatively sure of the outcome, and then figure out some way of actually introducing them to the atmosphere. The beauty of the technique is it doesn't have to be big perturbations. It can be pretty small. Not literally as small as butterflies, but relatively small. So that's one technique. There are other ideas that are more involved directly modifying the hurricane, for example. Wave-driven pumps that pump cold water to the surface ahead of the hurricane can reduce its intensity. So they're kind of out there, but they're not so far out there as that they're not deserving of more research and consideration.
Carrie, on a personal level, how worried are you about the unstable atmosphere we are leaving to the coming generations?
Well, I am worried about it. I'm also optimistic. I think enough people are beginning to take it seriously. I think enough people are on board with the idea that we're incurring risk for future generations that things are beginning to happen. And I'd also say another basis of optimism is that changing the way we generate energy and use energy, it's not all gloom and doom. There's some real opportunities here. Let me just state one. There are many, many that I think we have to consider. Right at the moment, according to the World Health Organization, about 8.7 million people die around the world prematurely as a consequence mostly of pulmonary problems stemming from aerosols from fossil fuel combustion. So in other words, burning fossil fuels kills almost 9 million people a year. Think about that a minute. If I said, well, nuclear power kills 900 people a year, there would be a huge outcry, and we would shut down all the nuclear power plants. Of course, it doesn't. But we're happily living with 9 million premature deaths. That's a great opportunity to solve that problem by cleaning up combustion or better yet, migrating to green energy, which doesn't have that problem. There are all kinds of economic opportunities for countries that develop clean energy most efficiently and cheaply and fastest are going to make out very well economically. So electric cars, you know, once you've driven an electric car, you would never go back to a gas engine. The electric motor is a thing of beauty. hardly ever needs even to be maintained. You can just forget about taking the car to the shop except to get the tires rotated and so forth. So there are a lot of things to be optimistic about, and yet the transformation is often painted by all kinds of different interests and journalists and so forth as a very negative thing. We're going to have to give up this way of life and go back to the Stone Ages. Not at all. I think we can make a lot of progress and wind up much better off than we are at the moment.
From the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, we've been speaking with world-leading expert in extreme weather, Dr. Kerry Emanuel. Look for his latest book, Climate Science and Climate Risk, A Primer for the Educated Non-Specialist. Find links to Kerry's website and all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Kerry, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Atlantic Ocean waters have been record hot for over a year, as you know. The U.S. government agency NOAA is forecasting a range of 17 to 25 total named storms for 2024. They also say there's an 85% chance of above-normal big storms. Scientists say we need to expand the hurricane rating system for storms to go past Cat 5. Standards for Cat 6 storms have been suggested. Hurricane Dorian in 2019 would have been a Cat 6. But what if that is not enough? Heating world oceans has unpleasant surprises that are hard to predict. One of the world's top climate scientists, former NASA head James Hansen, warned superstorms are coming. What does that mean? I talked with famous storm chaser and meteorologist Dr. Jeff Masters about this frightening possibility in a 2016 interview. Jeff tells you where we are and what disasters may roll out of heated seas. A huge scientific paper published by James Hansen and a group of international scientists contains dire warnings about how climate change will hit us. Perhaps none is more astounding than a prediction of superstorms this century greater than anything seen in human times. I don't have the scientific training to say this Hansen-led paper is right about superstorms or when they will come. In fact, it's hard to imagine storms we've never experienced, things not even perhaps described in ancient legends. But if Hansen is right, what would they look like? We can get help on that from one of the world's premier experts on violent weather. That would be Dr. Jeff Masters, the meteorologist who has flown into the eye of hurricanes, chased storms. He provides weather forecasts, and he writes regularly for the Weather Underground. Jeff, thank you for joining us again on Radio EcoShock.
Sure, Alex. Happy to be here.
Well, why don't we start here? What is the strongest storm recorded with modern instruments, say, in the last 100 years?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because back in the early 1960s, there was a typhoon in the Pacific called Nancy where they thought it had 215 mile per hour sustained winds. But that was taken with some very primitive sort of hurricane hunter measuring equipment. I mean, they didn't have modern GPS or inertial navigation, and that was basically just an estimate that was not deemed very reliable. So we thought for a long time that, you know, really there's never been a tropical cyclone worldwide that's had 200 mile per hour winds. But that changed last year. Back in October, we had a hurricane off the Pacific coast of Mexico, a hurricane named Patricia, that was measured by the hurricane hunters to have winds of 215 miles per hour. That's not a gust, that's sustained. Those are the winds you encounter in a high-end EF5 tornado, so absolutely devastating sort of winds. Fortunately, that hurricane weakened before it made landfall as a Category 4 storm with 150 mile-an-hour winds.
And do we know of great storms in earlier centuries, even if we don't have the instruments?
You know, we do. There are a lot of records of hurricanes going back to colonial times, and in particular, there's a hurricane called the Great Hurricane, which occurred during the American Revolutionary War back in 1780. Now, the Great Hurricane was one of the Cape Verde-type storms that come off the coast of Africa and then impact the Lesser Antilles Islands. And in October of 1780, when it moved ashore over Barbados, the winds of that hurricane were so strong that it leveled every tree on the island, destroyed every structure on the island, destroyed the forts, took the heavy two-ton cannons and threw them hundreds of feet away from the forts. And not only did it fell all the trees, but it took the bark off the trees, which is a phenomenon we've never, ever seen in any other tropical cyclone in history. But we do see in EF5 tornadoes, those type of tornadoes with 200-mile-per-hour winds. So the theory is that the Great Hurricane of 1780 may have been one of these freak storms that, you know, one in 1,000-year type of storms that did have EF5 tornado winds in it.
All right. Now, getting to the Hansen paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms, my understanding of that, and I'm pretty limited, is a shift in ocean currents in the North Atlantic brought on by ever faster melting on Greenland will create conditions that could lead to giant storms. Is that what you get from it?
Sure. I mean, what you're seeing is that the ocean temperatures in particular are going to increase because of not only global warming, but also a shift in the ocean currents. And in fact, we can maybe see a little bit of a beginning of that right now in the North Atlantic. Most of the North Atlantic is hotter than usual. In fact, the ocean temperatures worldwide have been at record or near record levels over the past year due to, you know, global warming and an ongoing El Nino event. But if you look in the North Atlantic by Iceland, there's this unusual cool spot. In fact, it's near record cold ocean temperatures are observed there. And the thought is that maybe that's due to the fact that this ocean current shift is starting to begin. The Gulf Stream current is carrying less warm water to the north than it used to, which causes a little bit of a cool water spot to develop up there. And since less warm water is being transported up there, that means there's more warm water further south in the Atlantic to pile up and cause warmer ocean conditions. So, yeah, I mean, we expect the oceans to warm over the coming century. And just a 2 or 3 degree increase in the warmth of oceans, that's enough to potentially drive superstorms. And in fact, Hurricane Patricia last year that formed off the coast of Mexico, that took advantage of the warmest ocean waters ever recorded in that portion of the ocean. So that helped fuel its rise to 215-mile-per-hour winds.
So is it fair to say that the mechanics of storm creation described in the paper, if they develop, would agree with what we know from meteorology today?
Yeah, theory supports the idea that if you crank up the thermostat, you're going to crank up the intensity of hurricanes. They're heat engines that extract heat energy from the ocean and convert it to the mechanical energy of their winds. You provide more heat in, and you're going to get stronger winds coming out. And it's very interesting, in fact, if you actually crank up the thermostat way high to, say, 120 degrees, at the surface, which is ridiculous as far as, you know, something we're not going to see in the next century or two due to global warming. But if you can somehow get the thermostat that high, you can get what are called hypercanes, which are kind of off-the-scale sort of hurricanes that have wind speeds over 500 miles per hour, central pressures down to 700 millibars, which is like only 70% of atmospheric pressure. And these storms go way to the top of the stratosphere. And we wouldn't want to see one of these storms because it can basically rearrange the entire climate system, cause destruction of the global ozone layer, and throw enough moisture high in the atmosphere that it'll block out the sun and cause kind of a volcanic winter scenario. So the models, you know, they're very clear. You provide more energy to the system, you're going to get stronger storms.
And Jeff, one of our scientific guests talked about baroclinicity, and I didn't really know what it means. What does that mean in meteorology?
Yeah, there's two main ways that storms get energy. One is through the energy of the ocean waters, like hurricanes do. And what they do is they take water vapor off of the ocean, and the water vapor holds what we call latent heat, which means the heat that was required to convert it to vapor form. It maintains that energy, and when the water condenses, or when the vapor condenses into water, it releases that energy and powers the storm. Now, there's another source of energy for storms called baroclinicity, and all that means it's the difference between cold air and warm air, basically, or cold, dense air and warm, moist air. And what happens is that if you've got cold, dense air up high in the atmosphere and it sinks and is replaced by warm, moist air, which is less dense near the surface, then that's a release of potential energy. You've got basically an object falling, and as it falls, it releases its energy and helps power the storm. And that's the energy source that blizzards use to get going, and the normal sort of low-pressure systems that, you know, march every few days across the mid-latitudes.
Okay, the other impact raised by Hansen et al., in fact, part of their proof, is a pattern of towering waves descending on the Caribbean from these storms, and it's partly dependent on the length of the ocean, or fetch, as the mariners say. Have you heard anything about larger-than-normal waves in the age of climate change?
It's tough. We don't have very good wave observations going back very far, but there is some thought that, yes, wave heights are increasing in some portions of some of the oceans, and it would stand to make sense. I mean, if you've got more heat energy available, I mean, that's potentially more energy to drive stronger winds and make bigger waves. So, yeah, we could potentially have bigger waves because of climate change.
I often wondered if there's any physical limit to how high waves could be. I don't really know.
Well, if you've got a 500-mile-per-hour wind, you're probably going to be able to get 200-foot-high waves. I mean, we've seen 100-foot-high waves in the oceans in huge hurricane-force storms. But, yeah, if you crank up the wind speed, I don't see any reason to have even bigger waves than that.
The idea of black swans, where things that were thought to be impossible turn out to really exist, has become fairly popular now. But the American scientist Carrie Emanuel is worried about gray swans. Can you tell us about that, Jeff Masters?
A black swan is an event that's totally unexpected that you wouldn't think could occur based on historical records or physical understanding. But a gray swan is an event that hasn't occurred in historical times. But if you look at the physics of how the atmosphere behaves, then you think that, yeah, you know, something like this is possible. And one of these storms I think we've already had in the past is this great hurricane of 1780, 200-mile-per-hour winds. It was able to debark trees. No other storm has been able to do that in recorded history. And if we look at the physics of how the atmosphere behaves, these sorts of storms can be anticipated now because we have the physical understanding. We know how the climate's changing. And Dr. Emanuel's paper thought that type of storm like the Great Hurricane of 1780, which maybe occurs only once every 1,000 years, can probably start occurring even more frequently than that with climate change, maybe by the end of the century, between one in every 400 years, or maybe even one in 60 years, depending on which climate model you're using. So I don't like those odds very good. I mean, yeah, a one in 100-year event doesn't sound very probable, but if you integrate over a 30-year period, then, you know, you keep rolling the dice, a 1% chance every year adds up, and then you have a 26% chance of a 1 in 100-year event happening. So basically, his gray swan paper is saying a hurricane like the Great Hurricane of 1780, you know, we're going to start seeing those by the end of the century. They're going to be, you know, once every 60 or 100 years on average, they're going to start popping up, whereas before you'd only expect one every 1,000 years.
And MIT seems to suggest that, based on this Emanuel paper, that these storms could pop up in places we haven't expected, maybe even in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's kind of strange to think, but yeah, the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, those have the hottest ocean temperatures of any bodies of water on the planet, and they are potentially going to get some pretty incredible storms. Those hot ocean temperatures are going to get even hotter with climate change. And, yeah, we could see a Category 4 storm forming and hitting Dubai, maybe, and causing unprecedented havoc with the oil and gas industry.
That would change prices at the pump as well.
Well, you know, we need to get over onto solar and wind as soon as possible for a lot of reasons, and that's one. I mean, the whole infrastructure for the oil and gas industry is highly vulnerable to storms, and it already has been disrupted by a number of storms in the past. I'm thinking Hurricane Katrina caused a big disruption to the Gulf of Mexico oil and gas industry. And certainly the Middle East is prone to disruptions as well. There have been an increasing number of very strong storms in the Arabian Sea in recent years. In fact, we had two of them hit the country of Yemen last year, and that was an unprecedented occurrence, two Category 3 or stronger storms. So, yeah, this sort of thing is something to think about when we're planning our energy infrastructure.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, meteorologist and storm expert, Dr. Jeff Masters. Let's move to the Southern Hemisphere, Jeff. We've seen awful, deadly tropical cyclones already there this century. It's hard to imagine they could get worse, but could they?
You know, it's very interesting and a little worrisome. When you look at the global database for strong tropical cyclones, which is the catch-all term that we use to describe hurricanes and typhoons and what they simply call tropical cyclones in the southern hemisphere, we haven't ever seen a storm as strong as we had this year back in February. Tropical Cyclone Winston, 185 mile-per-hour winds hit Fiji as a Category 5 storm, devastating that island, its most expensive natural disaster in history. So, yeah, the southern hemisphere had its strongest tropical cyclone in history this year. And over in the Indian Ocean, the southern Indian Ocean had its strongest tropical cyclone in history this year as well. Back in April, a storm called Fantala, 175 mile-per-hour winds. So in the span of just 8 months, we've seen the strongest tropical cyclone ever recorded in the South Indian Ocean. That was Fantala. The strongest ever recorded in the South Pacific. That was Winston, 185 mile-per-hour winds. And the strongest tropical cyclone ever recorded in the Northern Hemisphere, or the entire globe, actually, and that was Hurricane Patricia, with its 215 mile-per-hour winds back in October. So, you know, you look at that and you say, wow, I mean, if that isn't a warning shot over our bow, then what is? Maybe hearteningly, if you look at the longer-term statistics going back to 1990, which is the beginning of the good satellite record globally, we really can't say we see an increase in these most powerful of storms. I mean, the database isn't very long, though, and not very good. So the jury's out right now whether we're actually starting to see these changes. Certainly, climate models are expecting to see them. We expect the strongest storms to get stronger. But it's going to be a matter of decades, probably, before we can draw the line and connect the dots and say, okay, it's happening.
You know, in a recent program, we heard from a leader of the Carteret Islands. That's a chain in Papua New Guinea, which is being washed over by the sea to the point where they may become the first permanent climate refugees. If Hansen and his team are right, islands in different parts of the world may become uninhabitable in the next few decades, they're saying. What do you think?
Yeah, certainly sea level rise is already nibbling away at a number of islands. There's an island off the coast of Louisiana that is going to have to move, and they're in the process of trying to find the money to do it. A couple islands off the coast of Alaska, Kivalina, looks like they're going to have to move because of erosion problems due to rising seas. And that's going to continue to increase in coming decades. There's going to be, you know, a lot of trouble maintaining the defenses against the rising sea. And we're just simply going to have to abandon some areas because it's just not going to be cost-effective anymore to keep on putting up these barriers and replenishing beaches and so on. It's got to stop at some point. We've got to draw the line and say, okay, it's time to retreat.
Yes, and after every big cyclone or hurricane, politicians immediately promise, we will rebuild. They say that even in the lowest parts of Louisiana after Katrina or the most exposed parts of the East Coast after Sandy. I wonder when they'll start to say, we will relocate.
You know, it's written into the law. The part of the law for FEMA called the Stafford Act says that when we lose a chunk of land due to a storm surge, we have to put all the infrastructure back on that land. And there's a part of Alabama called Dauphin Island, which is off the coast. It's a barrier island. The western end of that island has been basically destroyed four or five times by hurricanes in the past 20 years, most recently in Hurricane Katrina. And the entire end of the island was washed away and moved. Oh, actually, it was moved closer to the coast by, you know, several hundred yards. And what the Army Corps had to do by law is go and dredge the sucker, put it back where it was, fill in the island, and put the streets and all the power lines and the sewers back there, because that's what the law said they had to do. And guess what? We paid for it. And there are several other places that are that way, too. Barrier Islands that are getting washed away more frequently in storm surges. And right now, the way the law is written is we got to keep on doing something that probably doesn't make sense. I mean, we've got to retreat from some of these barrier islands and take our time to put our resources where it makes more sense, defend parts of the coast that are worth defending, where they're more heavily populated and not so vulnerable.
I hear a law that needs to be changed. Now, Jeff, I picture a situation where storms and storm surges wreck major cities time after time, to the point where we can no longer afford to rebuild, a kind of death by a thousand nasty weather events. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, there have been cities in the past that have been abandoned due to multiple hurricane strikes. Indianola, I think is how you pronounce it, coastal city in Texas, got hit by a number of, I think, two different storm surges over a period of a few decades, and they basically abandoned the town. And that may be coming. I mean, certainly New Orleans is at risk. After Katrina, okay, they rebuilt the defenses. They put in $14 billion of new infrastructure. But if we get a Category 4 or 5 storm hitting New Orleans head-on, sort of a 1 in 200-year storm, then those defenses are not equipped to withstand that. And we may end up abandoning New Orleans in that case. I mean, the city will get flooded. The below-sea-level bowl will fill with water. And the people may just decide they don't want to come back. So we'll see. I mean, sea level rise, if Hansen is right, could be many meters by the end of the century, in which case we're going to start seeing not just one major city, but several probably have those sorts of reckoning, days of reckoning. The insurance industry is going to pull out, people are going to move, and we'll end up retreating.
Yes, and we didn't say the word Miami. Well, look, weather in the southern U.S. seems so strange lately. We've seen flooding and strings of tornadoes. Is that just part of life there, or do you think there's something unusual going on?
We've certainly seen that heavy downpours, the upper 1% of the spectrum, are increasing, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. And certainly the downpours in the south this past year are part of that trend. Now, they're also due to the fact we had an El Nino event, in fact, one of the strongest, if not the strongest, on record. And when you get that sort of naturally occurring event, it changes storm tracks so that you get more heavy rain-bearing storms moving over the southern U.S. So, yeah, partially natural, partially climate change. We are seeing an increase in the heaviest rain events, and what we saw this past winter was part of that trend.
As we wrap up, I'd like to get your thoughts on the Hansen-led paper, Ice Melt, Sea Level Rise, and Superstorms. Did you form a general impression of the storm predictions in there?
Hansen tends to be at the upper end of the dire scenario sort of scientific ideas of what are out there. If you look at some of the literature by other climate scientists, they don't see such a dire scenario happening. But universally, I hear these more cautious-sounding climate scientists say, you know, Hansen could be right. You know, he's at the upper end, but the science and the theory, the modeling, all says is that, yeah, it could happen this way. And we got to take into account not only the most probable outcome, but the upper-end sort of outcome, the outliers, because outliers do happen. And one thing we do know from past experience is surprises do happen. In fact, surprises are expected. We can't pigeonhole everything that's going to happen due to climate change because there's just too many variables. The climate's too chaotic and not well enough understood. We're going to get surprises, and some high-end surprises are more likely, unfortunately, than the low-end surprises, I think. We're going to get some off-scale disasters that we never saw coming, black swans. And, well, Hansen's giving us a gray swan sort of scenario here. I mean, we can anticipate some of this through theory and modeling.
I totally agree with what you've just said. Now, I haven't seen a Jeff Masters book about storms. Have you considered it?
I have a book, a fiction book I'm working on, which presents a sort of worst-case scenario, or plausible, not even worst case, but how things could be in 20 or 30 years, or maybe even today if we get a very bad weather year. I mean, it's not a very big stretch of the imagination to think that we could get a flooding event like wiped out the Mississippi River levee system in 1927, combined with a Category 5 hurricane maybe making landfall, and other worldwide extreme weather events, droughts in China, flooding in Europe, causing a crash to the global agricultural system, causing worldwide chaos, basically. So, yeah, that's my novel. I'm thinking of toning it down, maybe, because I don't want it to be, you know, apocalyptic. I want to have some hope. And there is hope in this whole scenario. I mean, people are very creative and very resourceful. And, you know, we have some of the answers we need to keep a disastrous future from happening, like, you know, could if we keep on going business as usual. So that's what I'm working on. I don't know if I'll ever finish it. I've been working on it 5 years already, and it just seems I haven't had the time to really put into it to get it whipped into shape, just because there's so much crazy weather to talk about on my blog all the time.
Well, that's the problem I have doing this show. I think I'm catching up, and then so many jaw-dropping things happen that you can't cover it all. I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking with meteorologist Jeff Masters. He's ridden government research planes into the eye of a hurricane, and no doubt he's driven some back roads looking for twisters. And now Jeff writes about big weather developments in the blog, The Weather Underground, at wonderground.com. And what else do you do, Jeff? Do you provide weather forecasting services?
Personally, I don't do that anymore. I mean, are you talking about my company or myself?
I'd like to know about your company.
We provide a web page that has, just for free, basically weather information for the world. You type in a location and get a forecast. We also have a network of personal weather stations. These are backyard sorts of weather stations that are over 200,000, I think, now. So we have just an unprecedented granularity to our weather that you can get. So not just forecasts, you can get these observations from personal weather stations all over the world. In fact, we've generate weather forecasts for those weather stations too. We also have a huge community that's very involved in participating in observing the weather and talking about it. My blog comments frequently run to several thousand per day. This kind of a online forum where people talk about the weather. We have 1.9 million user uploaded photos of weather that people have uploaded to share. Anybody who wants to can start their own blog to talk about the weather. We've got several hundred bloggers who write regularly about the weather on our website. And we've got a huge network of weather webcams as well. So it's just a giant hotbed of everything weather on our website. And I kind of anchor it by giving my daily commentary on what's going on in the world. And my main passion is for hurricanes. So this time of year, I start getting cranked up to talk about them. But during the rest of the year, and I'll talk about tornadoes and tornado season and winter storms and winter storm season.
And that's all at wonderground.com. Thank you so much, Jeff Masters, for your time and for your passion about all this.
All right, Alex, you're welcome.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
That was Dr. Jeff Masters speaking with Radio EcoShock back in 2016. Find links to follow up or download this interview in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Even if you don't live in a hurricane zone, these superstorms can wreck an economy. Masses of people become homeless depending on government and charitable aid. People are traumatized. Many leave the hurricane zones if they can. A diaspora, as we saw after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans. Insurance companies withdraw or collapse. Food or energy supplies may also be impacted by hurricanes. Everyone needs to know how these work and what is coming as we change the atmosphere. Next week on Radio EcoShock, we continue to explore hurricanes in a warming world. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Hello. Welcome to the future. To get you started, appetizers are on fire. The main course is hot. Pause, very hot. We have fried bees and dead fruit trees. We have displaced people huddled on the sand. We have the last deluxe tables on the damaged land. You have artificial views, and the ocean comes to you. You get mental storms and broken norms to enrich the chosen few. Welcome to the future, where everything is new.